Because when we work with kids, like I try to have like some craft kits ready. Like I make little kits of stuff that the therapist can just grab. Oh, look, Amy put together stuff for collages or whatever. I thought I would do that with the jars, and they got here and they were in a box shaped like the big phone, the one that's not quite an iPad, but also bigger than a phone.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
It was like the size of that. Oh, okay. And inside it were 30 tiny
crabs.
Like the size of the top third of my pinky finger.
Okay, that's weird. Okay.
Like, what am I going to do with those?
Tears. Like,
like
I said.
Let's
catch it. Take it away. We're not going to cry about that anymore.
This is when listening to you and your racist friend. I know politics bore you, but I feel like a hypocrite talking to you and your racist friend.
Welcome to My Racist Friend, a podcast
about the messy parts of relationships that help us grow together.
My name is Don Griffin.
And I'm Amy McKeese.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Let's talk about Dee Dee. Not only is she important in your life, but she's important for, what is it? RCV?
RCT?
She's a goddess in that realm. She's your mentor. She's
yes.
Your friend.
Yeah.
Yeah. I know she was. Did you end up visiting her?
Oh, yeah. We went.
That's what I thought.
Okay. Yeah. I visited twice. We went to Delaware, and then she came to stay with us.
Okay.
And let my youngest do her makeup.
Yeah, okay.
Then I went out last September to her house, because she was at home.
Yeah.
And hung out, and she did one of our cadre prompts.
And I remember how excited you were. Sorry. I remember how excited you were to actually develop this relationship with this person that you admired.
I could call her and like chew on anything. And like I could say it however I wanted to say it. When I was talking to her, I didn't feel like I had to get it right. Like I felt like we could just explore it together. Mm-hmm. And that was really special. But I listened to our podcast when she was on it, when we had brunch and podcast. She definitely made the sound even harder than we do for Kevin, because she wore like 80 bracelets and then was like running her hand across the table while she was talking. But she was so funny, and particularly like the two of you were sort of riffing off each other, and that was hilarious.
Identifying one true thing about a person, it will facilitate growth and movement in terms of the relationship. And all we have to do is just look for one true thing. That's all. You know, it doesn't have to be a slew of things or anything of that nature, but one thing about one person that you can share that you feel reflects the truth about them. And I think it's good because it's authentic. And it has a lot to do with the relationship, the movement of the relationship, because it validates the other person by identifying one true thing about them.
One thing that came up last year that they said, I don't remember who said it, but someone said it doesn't have to be one perfect thing.
No, it doesn't.
It just has to be one true thing. And I like that.
That's right.
Yeah.
So one true thing that you both can agree on about that person? I mean, can you give me an example?
One true thing about you is that you're honest. You have integrity, even though I don't like you.
Okay.
But that's one true thing about
it. Okay.
Okay.
Yeah. But deep down inside, you do like Don.
Hmm?
Deep down inside, you like Don.
Well, most assuredly, but this is for the
She's giving an example, I hope, because I'll start to cry.
It's all good. It's all good.
But I understand. So you try to find that thing that you can both agree on.
Exactly. And the fact that, you know, people are so enmeshed in negativity that I think it's liberating that you can go to the person that reflects that and share one true thing about them that you see. And that's healthy.
I like that.
I do too.
Told you I was cute.
Yeah.
You are.
Was that the only time I've seen her?
That was the only time she was here in person.
Yeah.
The one before that, she was she was on the iPad for it, but only
oh, yeah.
It was just like the top half of her eyes and her forehead.
Yeah.
I talked to her like a week and a half ago, and she was asking about my sister but the way she was doing it was like, what about that crazy sister of yours that got me a car and a cheeseburger? Because her flight got canceled and she somehow wound up in Midway instead of Indianapolis. Uh-huh. And I knew she was going to be late for her dinner as well. Mm-hmm. And at one point you told us that we couldn't ever both be hungry at the same time.
I don't remember that.
Yeah. So this guy picked her up and went to Burger King first and like got the stuff that she would like, and then picked her up and brought her down here from Chicago.
That is so funny. I can't believe I've only met her in person once.
Yeah,
because
she made a big impact.
And I feel like I created a friend for life, you know?
Yeah, she would, every single person she would ask about. She asked about you.
Me,
and,
yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And like all of our pets too.
What?
And my mom's, yeah, she had like a whole hierarchy.
Oh my
God. The pets were usually first, actually, and then she'd go into the people.
Okay, I love that.
Yeah. When she was sick and I couldn't figure out how to reach her, uh-huh. I just basically spammed anybody that I could find on the internet that had worked with her before.
Yeah.
I was thrilled to find her and, you know, find out that she was okay. Not okay, but on the mend. And like the people that responded to my email were like, oh yeah, Amy from Indiana. We know who you are.
Oh my God. Oh my goodness. How cool.
So I think we should probably go over the five good things. Just
yes.
Because I don't know the five good things.
The five good things are zest. And when you think of zest, what do you think of?
I'm hungry right now. So
oh, Jesus.
You asked me. I'm just, you said I was honest, and that's something that you liked about me.
That was a pretend person, Don.
So we were saying that hunger is zest?
I was thinking zesty, like a...
Oh, it's like a taste of something.
Yes.
No, darling.
Okay, explain it to me.
When you say so-and-so has so much zest, what are you saying about it?
They have a great spirit.
Okay.
Very good. They're excited about what they do. What they're
good. Energy.
Energy, yes.
All right, that's it.
Okay.
You got it.
She reminded me a little bit of my grandmother. Maybe that's why it hit me.
Yeah.
I hadn't thought of that till now. Life is funny, isn't it? It's like sometimes you have to hurt to realize the blessings that you had.
Yeah.
I got to know her. I got to meet her. I got to... You know, I had a good relationship with my father, or I got, you know, you start to think about, sometimes you need that shock to say, oh my gosh, life is actually good. And you only know that when you lose it, when you lose those good things.
I think there's also something to understanding that, you know, this lifetime is finite. What do you want to make sure that you get to share with the world during that time?
It's finite, but I guess maybe it's also like a relay. She's 80 something years old, still at it, still trying to make the world better. Not for her, but for that next person to hand the baton to.
I like that image of like passing the baton forward.
Everybody's not in that same race, though. Some people are observing or just living their daily lives. Everybody is not called to do that.
Yeah.
And that's okay. But there's some people that are, that's just in them. And that's in, That's in her. That's in you.
In order to experience the positive kinds of forces that we are talking about, one has to know what it is that they are experiencing it and able to give words to thoughts. And so, you know, and so often we say and do things and think that people understand without perhaps stopping to figure out, well, do they really know what I'm trying to convey? Because we just assume, and you know what that does to us, that everyone understands what we're trying, and that's not it. So we must take time to clarify what we're talking about, what we want to do, where we want to go. And so that everyone who wants to join with us has a clear understanding of the direction in which we're going.
She was involved in planning the Greensboro sit-ins. I don't remember how she met Joe Biden, but at some point she managed to get to meet Joe Biden, and it was at the time that everyone was talking about how handsy he is, like, okay. You know, and she was like, yes, he is, because he loves people, and that made me feel good, because he put his hands on my face and said, whatever he said, I don't know, but like, and I'm like, you realize that that's what people don't like about him? And she's like, well, then it's ridiculous that they don't like that, because it's love. He's just expressing how he cares by touching your face. Yeah, she was definitely a Biden stan.
Tell us more about her history, about things that she did.
Well, I have this clip that I want to share with you.
Okay.
What was this movie called? Tell Them We Are Rising. It's a documentary about the HBCUs and their involvement in the sit-ins and the civil rights movement.
Okay.
We deserve our rights, and we are going to get them one way or the other.
This was an opportunity to make a difference. We felt it was incumbent upon us, because we were young people, we were students, and we had a responsibility. We were going to be the future leaders. So now was a good time to begin to demonstrate what good leaders we could become. You sat and read your books. You caught up with your homework because you were students. It's just a matter of, you know, reading this chapter or whatever you had to do before you got back on the picket line. We were called niggas. We were spat on. People came by, threw cigarettes at you. It was very difficult not to fight back. I spent a lot of time on that picket line crying because I could not retaliate.
Whenever I would Google her, that would be the first thing that would pop up, is that she had been awarded some kind of Delaware prize for her role in the Greensboro sit-ins. The thing she would talk about the most was that there was a movie theater that wouldn't let Black people in. I mean, there were lots, but there was one in particular. And apparently they weren't very good at screening out the more light-skinned.
Okay.
And so she had a friend who was very fair. Very fair, and would get in and then would open the back door.
Okay.
And then they would all go in. And then the movie theater people would go in and realize that they had accidentally let a whole bunch of Black people in.
Oh, I love it.
And she just would like guffaw with delight while describing that. And the clip here where she was talking about, you know, people throwing cigarettes, and the video clips that are going on in the background of that, there's a lot of violence happening in the background. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of times people look at the civil rights movement as this very, there were a few like backwards people that were opposed to it, but in general, they were like this peaceful, pointing out that they should be allowed to have lunch at the same place, and then
or they think of it as a Southern thing, right?
Oh, right. Yeah.
And I've been looking at Black neighborhoods like Baldwin Hills and California, places like that had to be created. You know, upscale Black neighborhoods that were created because white folks, there was still redlining where they wouldn't let them move into, you know, other communities, even if they were doctors and lawyers and wealthy. So they had to create their own neighborhoods. And there's one in Indianapolis called Grandview Golden Ghetto is what is it was its nickname. They call it the Golden Ghetto. That's 1971. 1970.
It started in 1970?
A lot of the development was happening in the 1970s. It's funny because my grandfather, my grandparents who owned a pharmacy around Douglas Park in Indianapolis, they had a chance to either build where they ended up building, which was close to the drugstore, or go out to this area called, you know, near Grandview, this area called Grandview. Mm-hmm. Even though there was no real segregation, no one would sell black people things in the suburbs. So they had to create their own so-called suburb in this area. A lot of that stuff started off as white, but there was white flight happening. And so they were just selling to, you know, the idea that it was just a southern thing.
Yeah.
And we still have those effects here in the Midwest. The Midwest is still, in some respects, more racist than the South.
I just suddenly was thinking of the podcast Nice White People or Nice White Parents. I can't remember. It's a good one. It's about a school that had been almost all black, and then it got combined with another school.
Okay.
And then it wound up having a lot of like wealthy liberal white families joining.
Okay.
And they were, and you know, this was happening in, I guess, probably 2019.
Okay.
And the families were like, really like, oh, we want to help. We just want to, you know, help you raise money and be good PTO members. It was awful. Like, and actually felt familiar. Like I've seen that happen on smaller scales in meetings, you know, here in Bloomington, where like there's a family that is particularly well-to-do or well-connected, and they're like, okay, I will run things from here on out, and it's only out of benevolent concern for you.
Well, if we look at Tri-North's PTO, the demographics are mixed from the very poor to the very wealthy. They meet during noon or 1 o'clock, so nobody else can meet. They have tens of thousands of dollars, $30,000, $40,000, just depends. Yeah. And it's all ran by somewhat wealthy white folks.
You know, people with the flexibility to meet.
That's right.
In the middle of the day, too. Uh-huh. Yeah.
They love that their kids are in a urban school. However, they also want to make sure that they have an eye on
what's happening.
Yeah, and making sure that people are going to know that their child is safe, or they're going to make sure that don't mess with Mrs. Johnson's child, because you follow me? It's kind of ugly, but you're right. We do the same thing, but in a micro level.
Yeah.
Now, I have a thing about empowerment personally.
What's that thing?
We talk often about, in my particular profession, empowering people.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a very arrogant statement. How dare you think that you have the ability to empower anyone? We have responsibility to give people the tools with which they empower themselves. And that's when it has more meaning.
Mm-hmm.
So I think about empowerment as mutual empowerment.
Right.
You know, as opposed to I am the one who has been given the 10 tablets, okay, to empower you.
Okay.
So, well, what do we know about relationship? What does relationship mean? It means having a connection with another human being, in this sense, another human being. What are the qualities of that relationship? What qualifies that relationship, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And the desire to have that relationship is what makes all the difference in the world. And some people, because there have been disconnections in their lives, have difficulty in establishing meaningful, substantive kinds of relationships with others.
So one of these good things, the one you're talking about now, is really moving into more
relationships.
That's
what we want to have.
Okay, so I want to share something with you. On Facebook, there's a group called Master,
masterminds, real estate master. Okay, here it is. This is the statement that was made today. I was fired from a seller for bringing an African-American to cooperate with me and host an open house for me for the seller. How would you best handle the situation?
Wait, why? I don't understand.
This is what they're saying. They had a listing to sell someone's house.
Uh-huh.
They allowed their one of their African-American colleagues, who's a realtor or real estate agent, to host an open house at that house. And the seller fired them for doing it. The seller did not think it was okay to have a black person hosting their house. They didn't like it. And keep in mind, that happened to me in a neighborhood. Did we talk about this? Where I was marketing this very upscale. I mean, these condos are going for almost $900,000 now here in Bloomington.
What?
Right? They're in Hyde Park. And I was the first one to market those. And the developer came to me and said, hey, man, you know, like what you're doing, like everything that you're doing. But some of the investors, it really doesn't like the fact that your family comes and visits the site. He thinks it looks bad to have too many black people around here. It's not good for sales. So I don't know how you want to do it. I don't know how you want to talk to your family about coming and visiting the site, but
wow.
Yeah. Keep in mind, my little sister, Marcella, she was doing videography for this, like the making of this thing, you know, and my wife worked for the company. Me and my wife were doing this. This is 2001, 2002. Mm-hmm. I don't talk about that much because, you know, it didn't end well. Mm-hmm. That was a low moment in my life where I actually was like, well, okay. I mean, I should have just said, you know what? I'm out. But it was too much money. It was we had too much invested in it.
Yeah.
You know, it was just starting my company.
Yeah.
And
you had a little one.
And I had a little one. And we were investing all our money into marketing this thing because it was a big deal. But yeah, he told us, we really don't want, you know, but we're not racist.
I was going to say, it's not me, it's my father-in-law.
It's not racist.
It's the classic, I'm not racist argument.
And it's not really about us. It's like our target market. Maybe they don't want to see black people. It's not really you.
It's just that we think that all rich people are white.
Yeah, one of you are okay, but too many? Don't have your parents come and visit. Like, oh my gosh. You know, that is just a low moment for me in my life that I let someone control me and not, you know what I mean?
I think Dee Dee would love this conversation. I mean, she'd be pissed on your behalf and
rolling
her eyes.
Yeah, before I was going to get to the fact that it was the responses that really
bugged me. Oh, Lord, what were the responses?
First of all, a lot of people said, you're full of crap. This never happened.
Well, yeah, I just made it.
A lot of people were like, oh, you're full of crap. That didn't happen. One guy said, and no one said anything about it. He said, oh, you should go and loot the place. He's basically saying a black person would, you guys should go back and loot the place. Because that's what black people do.
Yeah.
Yeah. It just, there's little microaggressive thing from other real estate agents. And these people they're supposed to be masterminds. These are people that, you know, and so then you have black agents that are saying, hey, this happened to me. And this happened to me. And people are like, racism doesn't exist. Not in 20, blah, blah, blah. It doesn't exist. You're lying. You know what I mean? The stuff Dee Dee was dealing with, like, we have not overcome.
And the other thing is shame.
Or, you know, not shame.
Not shame. We don't want to shame. But that's
self-worth.
That has a sense to do with one's own value of self, your worthiness. And many people who experience shame feel unloved and maybe want to connect, but don't know how to. So that's where we help in that process. You know, how do you bridge the gaps? how do you make that move that is going to bring you into a deeper relationship with another human being? Mm-hmm. And it's kind of difficult when you don't feel good about yourself. So mm-hmm. part of that is enhancing one's sense of self-worth. Mm-hmm. And that you do have value. And sometimes we have to dig real deep to find it. You know, that piece of a person that we identify as valuable, and to show them, look, you can do this. Mm-hmm. That's wonderful. I've always wanted to be able to do that, mm-hmm. you know? And so we have to find those kinds of things in people that will enhance their own view of self.
Right. Yeah. Relational cultural theory involves finding strengths.
That's it.
Too. Right.
For strengths, yes. There's one more.
No, that was five. Sure. Right? Zest, clarity, empowerment, more relationships, self-worth.
Oh, okay.
You got it.
Oh,
pat yourself on the back.
Yes.
I did lose track of her several times and had to like go find her, right? And so at one point I finally figured out what rehab facility she was in. And I talked to the receptionist at like the operator. I just said, hey, I'm looking for this person and I can't find her. And the operator's like, oh, that's Dr. Dee Dee. I know exactly who she is. Yeah. And I'm going to connect you with the nurse on that floor. And the nurse was explaining how she would like bring Dee Dee out of her room and put her near this nursing station, and that everyone that would go by would call her doctor and basically ask for some advice or like
really
whatever was yeah.
Oh, and my God, that is so
it
her.
Was lovely. Yeah. And she was clearly enjoying it and talking about how she was keeping her skills up so she could go back to work. And yeah.
Oh, that is so cute.
I mean, she was super smart and like being able to celebrate that in an ongoing way.
Remember what you were just talking about, that she's there to help.
Yeah.
What she's here to do. That's what she is. That's her mission, to help others while she's supposed to be getting fixed.
Yeah.
She's fixing others.
Yeah.
Wow. She is going to be missed by a lot of people. And it hit me. I think it hit me because I just assumed that her presence would be here, even though I'm not here. I don't see her. Just knowing that she's somewhere in the world gives me hope and peace. And now that feels like there's a hole now.
Yeah. The same weekend that I very first met her, it was an RCT conference, and she was facilitating the social justice part of it. Once we met each other, like then we just weren't apart for the rest of the weekend, except that I did like to sleep and she didn't really care about sleeping.
Wow, so I love that.
I would be like, okay, y'all keep talking, I'm going to bed. You know, so we had spent like 36 hours nonstop together, and then she had to catch a flight early on that Sunday, and usually on the last day of these conferences, and we've done the same thing in the summit, we take time to think about like, what did we do here and what are we going to carry forward? And that particular Sunday was the same day as the Orlando shooting. She got to the airport and saw it on the news and called me as soon as she got it. And I remember I was like, well, it wasn't because it was a gay bar. It just happened to be one. That was my like initial defense, because I didn't.
You don't want to ever go there.
I didn't want to go there.
That's not us.
Yeah.
You don't live in a country like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I could still pretend that wasn't a thing. And she was like, oh, yeah, it was. And you'll get there, basically. She was very patient. That was a really interesting morning, because a lot of us hadn't really gone there because we were white, even though there was an RCT conference the weekend of the one where they took him to get Burger King after.
Oh, my gosh.
Charleston. Still starts with a CH. But there was a lot of raw emotion in the room that morning. And there was always like a table of Black women that would sit I think we broke that a little bit because Dee Dee and I sat together pretty much the whole weekend. Mm-hmm. And some of her friends came over and I didn't have any, but Dee Dee. The big feelings were coming up. And one of the Black women said, "Welcome to our world. Mm-hmm. We're not going to hold your hand right now because we've been trying to say this for years."
Yeah.
But even my experience that morning was shaped by having spent the weekend with Dee Dee, like, and
that takes a lot. Creating the boundary, mm-hmm. or becoming the boundary that me and you have been talking about, to say, no stupid question is really stupid. Ask me. And I'm going to be caring and compassionate about how to explain it to you.
Mm-hmm. First, I'm going to say, "I don't like you very much," or whatever it was that she said.
Yeah. She liked me, folks.
Yeah, she definitely liked you.
I think she did.
Yeah.
I liked her. That hurt a little bit.
Yeah. I imagine a lot of people loved her. Like, I think she had students that were just nuts about her. And she would take them on trips to Cuba. That was her favorite place.
Ooh.
It's hard to lose someone, and it's better to have someone to share it with, too. Other people who loved her and she had an impact on.
She really did. Thank you.
Thank you.
This episode of My Racist Friend is a production of the Bloomington Center for Connection, an organization using relational cultural theory to promote social change through connection. This conversation between Don Griffin Jr. and Amy McKeese, LCSW, took place on April 1st, 2024, in Bloomington, Indiana. Excerpts of Dr. Dolores Fingerwright were recorded on September 22nd, 2019, and from the 2017 documentary, Tell Them We Are Rising, highlighting her experiences organizing the 1960 Greensboro sit-in. This podcast was edited by Kevin McKeese. Theme music lovingly sampled from Your Racist Friend by They Might Be Giants. Follow Bloomington Center for Connection on Facebook and other social media platforms. We miss you, Dr. D. You and your racist
friend. All right, you think of something else. You just holler.
Yes, ma'am. Thank
you. And we'll pull you right back up.
Can we keep those cards, though?
Are you going to take your cards away? You going to let us hold them for a little bit?
They're mine. Don't try to shame me into giving them to you. That's not going to work.
Oh, my gosh.
Okay. Thank you very much for this opportunity.
No, thank you very much.
I'm so glad you've been here.